Hello and welcome to the She Research Podcast. I'm your host, Diego Silva. Before introducing our guests, I want to acknowledge that we're recording on the unceded territory of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. This is and will continue to be Aboriginal land. I want to pay my respects to those who have and continue to care for country. I'm really lucky today I'm joined by Dr. Phoebe Williams to discuss their paper, Coverage Gaps in Empiric Antibiotic Regimens and to Treat Serious Bacterial Infections in Neonates and Children in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. Looking forward to digging into some of the ethical issues therein. Phoebe, thank you so much. Welcome.
No, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So just to begin, I wonder if you could just provide a brief summary of the paper and some of the arguments therein.
Yeah, so this paper that we published towards the end of 2023 involved us looking at the contemporary published literature around antibiotic-resistant infections in children. And we focused on the Southeast Asia region because we know that there's a very high burden of infectious disease there. And there's also rapidly, increasingly, a high burden of antibiotic resistance. So within my role as an NHMRC fellow, I coordinate a project called NEOSEEP, which stands for Neonatal Sepsis in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And what we were seeing when we went to these clinical sites and did a ward round was that there were wards and wards of babies with multi-drug resistant infections. And clinicians were using all they could to treat these babies with, and there was often nothing left in the cupboard that they could use to treat these infections with. But we just weren't seeing that in the literature. And it became clear to us that one of those reasons is because the clinicians are far too busy treating this huge burden of, infection and AMR that is occurring in Southeast Asia to have the time to get some of these data out. And so this paper was a literature review, and then we built what's called a whisker, a weighted incidence syndromic combination antibiogram. Sounds very fancy, but luckily I had some very good mathematicians who worked with me on that. And that's a Bayesian tool that helps both incorporate what might be the bacteria that are causing common infections in children. So it looks at the probability that each infectious syndrome might be caused by a particular bacteria, and what is known about the antibiotic resistance of those bacteria when people or children in the area have that infection. And what we found was that really what correlated with what we were seeing anecdotally, clinically, that there's very high rates of resistance to the currently recommended antibiotics that the World Health Organization suggests are used to treat common childhood infections like sepsis and meningitis.
Why, it's really a background question for myself and the listeners, why is the situation as dire as it is in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you know, there's certainly a very high prevalence of infectious disease in temperate climates. I did my PhD in Kenya in sub-Saharan Africa, again, another region of the world that has a very high prevalence of infectious disease, both because of the climate, but also because of the underlying social determinants of health that mean that there might be overcrowding in the community, malnutrition in children, malnutrition in delivering women. There's less access to some good preventative clinical care in the community. So you tend to get very high numbers of hospital presentations for infections. And then the hospitals themselves are quite frequently very overwhelmed. So it's not unusual for there to be two or sometimes even three babies to a bed in the neonatal intensive care units. The clinicians are working absolutely around the clock, putting in sort of 14-hour days, trying to treat the number of admissions that they have. And then the antibiotic resistance that we're starting to see there tends to occur because for example, neonatal intensive care units, we now have the ability to keep babies alive from when they're born very early. So we've made amazing advances in medicine that mean that premature babies can, be kept alive from, as early as 23 weeks gestation now. But that means that after they're born, they then have a very long time that they spend in hospital. And when you have babies that are really like immunocompromised little beings without very good immune systems because they're born so early, sitting in settings that are very crowded with three babies to a bed, and if one of those babies in the ward gets an infection with a multi-drug resistant bacteria, it spreads very, very quickly because the babies are very vulnerable and the wards are overcrowded. And infection prevention and control resources, which tend to keep infections at bay, might not be as well funded as they are in places like Australia.
Yeah, reading your paper raised a whole host of issues, and one of them is this idea of, I guess, the poverty and the situation in which you're kind of conducting this research. In the paper, you write, quote, "Our analysis has revealed that the geographically imbalanced and sparse low-quality data available to inform the development of coverage estimates of routine empirical antibiotics in Southeast Asia and the Pacific indicates the urgent need for more robust, systematically collected prospective surveillance data to better understand the causes of serious bacterial infections in children in neonates LMIC settings," end quote. So just given what you've said just a moment ago, it seems like a big part of the problem is, you know, global inequities and global inequalities in access to health resources and poverty itself. So I guess my question is, why do we need more data? And I guess also, what will more data tell us about the causes of serious bacterial infections in children and LMICs?
Yeah, so clinicians are trained through medical school and through their clinical training to usually follow guidelines and algorithms and, you know, to first of all work out when a patient's in front of them, what might that patient have? And then when they do work out, oh, this patient has meningitis, there's very clear guidelines as to, okay, this is the best medication you can give them to cure them. In many parts of the world, those guidelines come from the World Health Organization, especially for treating children. There's a couple of great resources called the Pocketbook of Hospital Care for Children. But the challenge is the WHO uses the published data to create those guidelines, and the published data all comes from high-income countries because it requires people that have health systems that can support having clinicians or researchers to have protected time to do research and get their data into the literature. So the last time the WHO updated that pocketbook of hospital care was back in 2013. So it's already sort of 11 years out of date. And with most of the recommendations coming on the back of data about neonatal and pediatric infections that have come from high-income countries, we know that they're just not representative of what bacteria are causing infections in LMICs and what the antimicrobial resistance rates are of those bacteria. And that tends to be, you know, as I mentioned, because there's not the research capacity to, you know, have the time to get these data into the literature. And also just because, you know, in some settings, we might not even have the labs that can, in the first instance, you know, ascertain what bacteria are resistant to. So there needs to be often a lot of what we call empirical treatment, which is giving lots of antibiotics to cover lots of potential infections because there might not be the microbiological facilities to get that, you know, granular data out about, you know, what bacteria are resistant to locally. And so if we're going to make sure that clinicians are following guidelines that are going to treat the baby in front of them, we need to make sure that those guidelines are based on data from really where the burden of disease is highest, which is, you know, not in high-income countries, but it's in LMICs.
Right. So if I'm understanding correctly, the word cause there has sort of two meanings. So one is, you know, sort of the upstream causes, and then there's sort of the immediate cause. And so if you're, you know, if you're looking at the immediate cause, that's where the surveillance data is lacking.
Yeah. Because we know that in, you know, this crowded area of Indonesia, most of the babies are actually getting sick from this bacteria, which is this likely to be resistant to the currently recommended antibiotics. And so in some hospitals, you know, the mortality rate can be up to 75% for those babies because the clinicians are doing the right thing by following the WHO guidelines, but they're just, you know, completely disconnected from what is causing infections and what the antimicrobial resistance profiles are in those settings.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Again, in my mind, it's fascinating just, you know, this idea in a lot of social justice literature around in health, sort of the compounding of inequalities. And I think this is a great example of exactly that, right? Because it's not just the health system that is strained and the poverty that sort of pre-exists, but even just the inability to do research, the inability to have time to do data collection and whatnot has this amplification, this multiplier effect.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when I do rounds in these settings, it is like the clinicians are just so hardworking and so dedicated, and they're clutching at straws to think of anything they can to treat many of these babies that just get sicker and sicker in front of their eyes. But, you know, without funding, you know, that equitable resource allocation across healthcare globally, so that we have, you know, not just the time to do research, but also the capacity building to have the labs and the, you know, way that data can be fed to inform global programs like the guidelines the WHO puts out. You know, it's that dichotomous, you know, dichotomy is always going to be there.
Yeah. So your paper actually, it was published at the end of last year, I believe, right? And it got picked up a lot of media coverage, certainly here in Australia. I was doing a little bit of digging, and it was really interesting to see the headlines from the ABC and the Sydney Morning Herald, and amongst others. And the headlines read something like, childhood AMR was, quote, on Australia's doorstep. So that, a couple of the headlines picked up on that sort of soundbite. So this is something I struggle with, because like I see the need to appeal to the audience to get them to listen to your message. So I remember when I was doing COVID stuff, you know, you're trying to get the message across to a population that, you know, may or may not have the sort of background. I always wondered to myself, when we make instrumental arguments about X or Y being important, as opposed to saying, look, X and Y are important because people are dying, even if not, you know, even if they are economically poor and not white, I wonder what it is I'm giving up by making instrumental arguments in the first place. So I'm curious, from your perspective, how do you navigate this challenge, like the need to be relevant to those with money and power and the publics therein, versus arguing for the importance of, say, AMR in Southeast Asia on its own merits?
Yeah, no, it's a very, very good point. And I have been in medical school or working in sort of, you know, research in healthcare for nearly 20 years now. And initially, a lot of my research was actually focused on malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. And then sort of gradually I've moved into the AMR space, but always done research on children in resource-constrained settings. And my interest in that topic came from an undergraduate degree in development economics. And so before I did medicine, I sort of realized that, you know, a lot of health outcomes come from the social determinants of health, and that's what's always then driven my research interests being in that space. And I remember as a, you know, young graduate medical student doing my honours project on a malaria program in sub-Saharan Africa, and I could see the disinterest when I would tell, you know, older generational white academics, you know, about the urgency of this problem. And, you know, the at that stage, very few households that had access to insecticide treated nets. And when we did do this program where we distributed some nets, we, you know, would then went back a year later and we saw that the nets were being used by the male head of the household only. And lots of the children had died of malaria because they didn't get access to the nets. And, you know, as a young and motivated medical student, I couldn't believe that people don't care enough that they want to dedicate part of their medical career to always, you know, collaborating with settings like that, given that's where the burden of healthcare needs are greatest. And then as I have evolved through my academic and clinical career, I've realized that, you know, for a lot of people, getting them to engage with what's happening there beyond their borders is very difficult. I think it's difficult, particularly in Australia, because we have a really inward-looking news cycle. You know, our news programs are very much focused on what's happening locally. You know, they barely even talk about regional issues in Australia, let alone what's happening overseas. And so I have come to realize, and I did see a lot of those headlines through that time, that this paper fortunately did get some attention. But I have come to realize that often, you know, you do need to bring that link back to, but how does this affect Australia's borders and Australia's patients? And why should I care about this if it's not happening in Australia's hospitals? And so some of those interviews were on that topic. And, you know, to me, as a clinician that works in Australia, I could make it relevant because we certainly are seeing multi-drug resistant infections here. And I can think of one baby that's died in the last year in a facility that we were giving some advice on, who was very, very sick with a multi-drug resistant infection. But it's certainly nowhere near the scale that I see when I go to my site visits in Indonesia and the Philippines. And that has been a moral challenge that I have really struggled with over my career. And I think as I've gotten older, I've realized that for some people that that understanding just isn't there. And sometimes from, you know, time spent overseas living or working, you know, they do get a little bit of an understanding of those, you know, massive inequities. But it is something that I've found very hard across my career.
Yeah, it's a perennial challenge, I feel like, for those of us who are trying to do sort of policy or programmatically relevant,
yeah.
Right? Because the purse strings are not where they need to be. And it's a difficult one. One of the other challenges I kind of want to ask you about, and I know this is something that it's a challenge that we face as bioethics researchers, and it's one that we face as global health researchers, and, you know, the very small Venn diagram of those of us who do both. Wanting to be researchers who allow the research to speak for itself so that it can seem quote-unquote objective, we'll bracket whatever objective means, but we have a sense of what that means, with the desire to do more, to advocate to for those without a voice, to kind of stand with those without a voice. And there's a tension between both, certainly among sort of policymakers who want to be evidence-based and even amongst a lot of our colleagues who want to be sort of evidence-based. So I'm wondering, as a global health researcher who's interested and has a stake in improving global health, how do you see your role in creating a database, creating an evidence base, and advocating? Do you see it as a tension?
Yeah, I really think that clinicians, as part of almost their Hippocratic oath, have a role that whereby they should be advocates as part of their career, whether or not you're involved in research or academia at all. And I've been giving a few lectures to their MD students, and I always pick up on that. I think that there is an inherent level of trust that the community has from, you know, when they hear clinicians talk. And I think that we have a really humbling position in our roles that mean that we get a lot of insight to the lives and healthcare needs of some of the most vulnerable people in the world who don't have the ability to voice, you know, the challenges that they might be experiencing. So I have always, especially as a pediatrician, because children in particular can't often advocate for themselves, I've always really tried to be quite active in the advocacy space. It's not always easy, though. I was part of some research that looked at how, you know, COVID in children was evolving and really the urgency with which we needed to get schools reopened. And on the back of that research, had a few articles published in the media here in Australia, and I was very quickly absolutely attacked on social media, and people dived into my personal life and found out I had 4 kids and said, oh, she just wants the schools open to get her kids back at school. And it's not an easy space to be as an advocate, but I really feel as a clinician, and now particularly as a clinician that works in resource-constrained healthcare settings where they might not necessarily have the seat at the WHO meetings that I might be offered to attend, or they might not even have the time to write a paper because they're working so hard just putting out fires on the ward all day, that I can try my best to be a voice, not so much for them, but with them. And I have close relationships with all our collaborators in Southeast Asia and always make sure the messages that I'm sharing, you know, in keeping with the messages they'd like shared. But I think in an ideal world, that power, equity, and, you know, contribution in the advocacy and the global health space should come from all countries and all voices.
So I'm sorry that you had to face that backlash. That's, I mean, terrifying / unacceptable. And I think it actually adds a dimension, which is, yeah, I mean, being in that public eye, it can be weird, and it can be weird even from your own colleagues, I think, sometime as well. I think it raises this whole bigger issue about challenging norms in moments of uncertainty. So I think it's a really difficult, thorny issue. One of the last questions I want to ask you is, it seems like it might have been a challenging paper to write from the outside, because it is such a complex issue, this idea of AMR. Were there challenges? How was the process of, you know, of working with the mathematicians, working with the local clinicians, and publishing this paper? What was that process like?
Yeah, well, I think anyone working in academia knows the long, drawn-out process behind any paper finally reaching publication. This was to be honest, there were challenges, but it was actually a really exciting paper to write because it enacted new collaborations with researchers and clinicians across Southeast Asia that I'd not previously worked with, and then bringing in the input from the mathematicians. It was an interesting way for us to be able to present the data, and in a data that's probably a lot more relevant for clinicians and policymakers and the media to be able to understand and digest it. But for me, I think the far more challenging thing is actually now, because this paper was based on building this, you know, Bayesian anti-up biogram on the basis of the published data in the literature. But what we're now doing is collecting the data in each site across our Southeast Asian collaboration, where we can, where there's some good microbiological data available. And hospital by hospital, we're now trying to put together our own database, because that was what was so clear was missing when we looked at the literature. And that is a lot more challenging than writing a paper is, because, you know, we'll have some fantastic, hardworking colleagues who we'll meet with on Zoom every week who will be really positive and keen to contribute to this work. And then we'll notice that there's sort of a gap of 3 months where no blood culture data has been put into the database, for example. And, you know, often it's really hard to understand why these gaps and missing data might be occurring. And then when we go to the site, we realize it's because they've actually run out of blood culture bottles and they've been trying to order them. But the government has said they've got to cut back on their budget and blood culture bottles are too expensive. Or the one scientist that can interpret blood cultures has gone on maternity leave for a year. So writing a paper that involved, you know, building this Bayesian model from the published literature was challenging, as all papers can be, but trying to build, you know, a research network to ascertain some better data and going sort of site by site across Southeast Asia to do that with all the challenges that these many sites face is certainly proving a much bigger challenge.
Well, yeah, that sounds exciting, challenging and exciting. What are you working on, and what can we look forward to reading from you soon?
Yeah, so hopefully in the next couple of months, we will have our first paper from sort of 10 clinical sites across Southeast Asia, where we've now gone and gathered our own data from places where it was really clear there wasn't enough in the literature from. So, you know, from countries including Vietnam, Indonesia, the Philippines. We've started to present a lot of those data at some big international conferences. And what we've tried to really do with our collaboration is make sure that the in-country leads present those data rather than it coming from us here at Sydney University. So we've been really lucky to have a few scholarships afforded to our colleagues in Vietnam and Sri Lanka, who have gone to sort of major international conferences over the last 6 months to share some of those data. And we're hoping to then have that out. And then the next step is we're looking at doing some prospective surveillance and looking at some interventions in each of these units that might reduce the burden of infection. And so simple things like kangaroo mother care, you know, that skin to skin mother baby contact, you know, looking at the way that formula is made in the unit, looking at hand hygiene rates and audits and some simple interventions like that that might reduce the burden of infection in each of these sites.
Well, thank you so much, Phoebe, for joining us today. Thanks for listening to the episode of She Research Podcast. You can find the paper that we've discussed today linked in the episode's notes, along with the transcript. She Pod is produced by She Network and edited by Regina Botros. You can find our other episodes on Spotify, Radio Public, Anchor, wherever you get your podcasts of quality. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.